Our speaker this morning is Dr. James Hackler. This is what he asked me to tell you about him. I am a retired professor of sociology, criminology from the University of Alberta, who was invited to teach sociology of law at the University of Victoria. My major task while retired has been to summarize some of the outstanding research that has been done and present it to any group that will listen. But this is the more that I want you to know. His activities with the Canadian Criminal Justice Association, the Citizens Advisory Board for the Parole Service, the Community Social Planning Council, the Cridge Center for the Family, the Family Court and Youth Justice Committee, and the Kool-Aid Society have helped to build bridges among a variety of community organizations involved with social issues. At the conclusion of the service, Jim will lead a discussion circle. So get a coffee and bring it back to the sanctuary to join him. Dr. James Hackler. Jim, to most of us.
When I was a student at the University of California, I sang in the men's glee club. I was also under the delusion that I could lead people in group singing. This fantasy was fostered by my attendance at campfires. Too close?
You don't have to lean forward quite so much. Just okay. The distance away, more comfortable.
This fantasy that I could lead singing groups was fostered by my attendance at campfires in Yosemite National Park and a willingness to leap up and get people singing. Could I lead a choir of blind people? I approached the California Institute for the Blind, which had a residence near Berkeley. The director of the residence was helpful. Soon, I was in front of a group of blind people singing around a piano. We enjoyed ourselves, and I began thinking of ways that I could communicate. Perhaps using sticks and strings would let me indicate when we should begin and when we should end. From time to time, I spoke with the director. What was I hoping to achieve? Well, I thought it would be nice if I could become famous as the director of a blind choir. People would think I was a wonderful person. What would it do for the blind people? Well, they would enjoy themselves. But the blind people in this residence were not typical. They did not cope well with the outside world. Most blind people function in the larger society. These people felt less adequate. That's why they stayed in this special residence. Could these people sing in a regular choir with normal people? Would it be better if they got out into the world? Would they be accepted in normal choirs? I went around to the nearby churches with choirs. Could a blind person sing in their choir? Of course. They would have to listen carefully, but they would manage. As I made arrangements for people to go outside and sing in nearby choirs, my choir dissolved. My chance for fame also disappeared. Whose needs were being met? Was it my ego that got me started? Was my need to call attention to myself more important than really helping others? The urge to help takes many forms, and we should not be ashamed if that urge brings us personal satisfaction. But it is probably healthy to to recognize when our own needs are being met. Now, I want to be seen as a caring, helpful person. That's quite compatible with being a caring, helpful person. But maintaining the facade is not the same thing. Do I care more about the facade than I do the reality? Actually, from the standpoint of society, it may not matter. If I want people to think of me as being a caring person, I have to continually do helpful things. Thus, good things get done. What motivates me to help may not really matter. Society benefits from what I do. What encourages me to do good things may be of concern to me, but it may not be of great concern to others. There are many conditions that promote helping behavior. The research on this topic is vast. Learning to share can be influenced by simple things. When my sister was about 4 years old, my mother gave her a bone to give to the neighbor's dog. My sister carried the bone out the back door and did not return for some time. We looked out the back window and saw my sister squatting by the wire fence, which had large spaces. The dog was on the other side of the fence. My sister would hold the bone through the space and the dog would chew on it. Then my sister would pull the bone back and chew on it. And the dog patiently waited for his turn. Now, sharing and helping can be influenced by many things, such as having a fence that lets people and dogs interact. Some fences are barriers as social interaction and the likelihood of helping. Simple things matter. But sometimes the dynamics are hard to predict. Imagine an area in Africa with malaria. A local manufacturer of mosquito netting employs 10 people. Those 10 people support 50 other persons. The manufacturer can sell all of his mosquito netting, everything he produces, and is considering expanding his business. A rock star in the United States wants to raise money for mosquito netting in this part of Africa. He gives concerts, raises thousands of dollars, buys mosquito nets made in China, and ships them to Africa. The Africans are pleased to receive this gift. But the local manufacturer of mosquito netting is forced out of business. His 10 employees and their 50 dependents suffer. In 5 years, the donated mosquito netting is torn and no longer useful. There is no longer a local manufacturer of mosquito netting. He was put out of business. The rock star has gone on to support other charities. Does the desire to do good or be seen as doing good lead us to be careless about how we help? Should we weigh the consequences of our decisions? Dambisa Moyo, an economist born in Zambia, in a book entitled Dead Aid, argues that foreign aid to Africa has taught Africans how to beg, rather than to be resourceful. She claims that foreign aid has made things worse for Africans. In addition, foreign aid makes it worthwhile for dictators to remain in power and for other powerful people to gain power. Michael Ignatieff a name some of you have heard, has argued that when areas are ravaged by war, charitable organizations provide food, shelter, and medical care. Food sent to such areas sometimes gets to starving people, but it also feeds the soldiers who control the supply lines. Ignatieff poses the question, does the outside aid enable civil war to continue? The alternative to helping is tremendous suffering, but does our help actually sustain the war itself? Would the war become unsustainable and collapse if outside aid did not materialize? How does one avoid doing harm in the long run? Secondly, how does one select a project where there is evidence, not just hope, but evidence of positive, a genuine positive impact? We are constantly bombarded by projects that seem to be attractive. How can we distinguish projects that actually accomplish something from those that simply appear to be positive? Now, many of you have seen a very attractive brochure showing that you can donate animals to a developing country for a certain price. Children like this brochure because they can select cuddly animals. Suppose one chooses to send two chickens. Does the recipient have a chicken coop? Will the eggs be laid where the rats will eat them? Will the chickens be killed by raccoons? By contrast, imagine a woman who has borrowed money from a microcredit organization and wishes to buy two chickens. Has she already built a chicken coop? Is she knowledgeable about chickens? Which of these two situations is more likely to lead to success? Are there guidelines that would help us make better choices? Should we favor countries that have less corruption? Botswana is less corrupt than most other African nations. It seems to use its diamond mines more effectively than Nigeria uses its oil. Botswana has better schools and a higher standard of living. But would we get a better return if we invested in Botswana, even though more corrupt countries have much greater needs? If we give animals to people in Africa, are some animals worth more than others? Goats are tough, but they also damage the environment. In the long run, do goats do more harm than good? Now, I'm biased toward the use of research findings. We have considerable evidence that educating girls in developing countries yields a better social return than educating boys. Educated girls marry later and produce fewer and healthier babies. But what do we do if the girls in an African village are expected to grind the grain, which is time-consuming? They do not have time to go to school. However, if you buy a grist mill, the grain would be ground rapidly, and the girls would have time to go to school. And who knows? A boy might run a machine, even though it would be beneath him to grind grain by hand. That's work for girls. The 300 members of the Getting Higher Choir support a school in Mozambique. Children are now graduating from that elementary school. If they want to go on to high school, they have to go to another town and stay in a boarding school. How much does it cost to send a student to this high school? Pay for the tuition, purchase the books, and provide room and board for an entire year. Yes. $150. Sounds like a good deal to me. Now, in addition to examining a project carefully, should we also ask how the money is being raised? Let us return to the glossy brochure with the animals. Was this done by a clever fundraiser? What percentage of the funds donated go to the fundraiser as compared to those who actually are working in the field? So where, what percentage of the money goes where? How do we choose? Do we write checks for many different charities that come in our mailbox? Or do we select a few and those that we have examined carefully? Some of us have considered leaving money to charity in our wills. Suppose you wish to have, say, you want to give $500,000 to save the penguins or some other cause. Who knows how to save penguins? Who will handle the money? Now let us deal only with the last question. Who should handle our estate or our money? My uncle left his wife with a modest estate. They had no children, and his wife had little experience with finances. A trust company managed her finances, paid her bills, found care services, took care of the funeral, for a price, naturally. She had signed over her entire estate to the trust company for $1, and they had complete control. When she died, the remainder of her estate, around $1 million, was to be used to help children. As the last relative, I suggested that the remaining funds be paid out on a sizable project and that the account be closed so that almost all the funds could be used to help children. There were no other relatives involved. No one would care in the future. The trust company refused. They would invest the money, and a portion of the yield or earnings would be used to help children. Although it was difficult to get information from the trust company, it seems that for every dollar used for children, $6 went into the hands of those handling the money. How long would this last? Forever. The money from this estate continues to enrich the money handlers, while the children receive very little. I do not trust banks and their trust companies. Perhaps criminologists are cynical. We are aware of the high level of criminality and unethical practices that are endemic among financial institutions, as we see in the news today. Finding someone who understands what you wish to do, has the ability to do it, knows how to handle the funds, and can be trusted is not an easy task. Just putting your wishes in your will may not be enough. Can research findings help? Is knowledge available that can guide our choices? Are there simple things that make a difference? In England, fights in bars can lead to serious facial injuries. Drunken men sometimes smash part of a beer mug, turning it into a dangerous weapon. One surgeon asked if a beer mug could be made that would not shatter and produce sharp edges. Such a mug was made and was used in a large number of bars. When compared with others, the new mug resulted in fewer and less serious facial injuries. Sometimes simple changes have a large impact. common sense, you might say. Why do we waste money doing research on the obvious? What seems obvious today wasn't always obvious. In the time of Charles Dickens, it was obvious to some people that if criminals were placed in prison, in isolation, they could pray. Thus, they would find God and give up their evil ways. But penitentiaries didn't work. Now, soon afterwards, medical experts assured us that women were criminal because they were hysterical. A simple operation, a lobotomy, would calm them down and turn them into law-abiding persons. A lobotomy did calm them down. Now, over 50 years ago, I went to a lecture by a prominent geographer. He explained that Great Britain became a great world power because it had a plentiful supply of coal and could provide energy for the Industrial Revolution. In the future, he claimed, those countries with lots of energy sources, mainly sunshine, this would generate energy, and this would allow them to attain greatness. With all the confidence of a senior professor from a good university, he assured us that the leading industrial companies of the world by 2015, a couple years from now, would be where? Africa. Africa would lead the world as in all sorts of things because they had this abundant source of power. Academics can develop tunnel vision. They focus on their specialty and ignore other ideas. Like a child with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. A few hundred years ago, a philosopher assured his pupils that humans will never fly. Boats are lighter than water, so they float. Humans are heavier than air. They will never fly. What's that you see out the window? Don Vipon? You say that's a verb out there? A bird out there? And it just flew away? Yes, birds are heavier than air, yes. Now look, today, you're the student, I'm the professor. There's not going to be anything on the exam about birds. We shouldn't rely too much on so-called experts. But the question still remains, should we use what knowledge we have and attempt to assess the impact made by our financial donations? Obviously, we need not evaluate every charitable gesture. Being involved, doing good deeds, and being involved with others has many different benefits. But for our larger contributions of time and resources, should we make an effort to get a good return from our investment? Now, let me close with a personal experience. The 11-year-old boy in my 7th grade class was not being cooperative. I slammed my hand down on his desk and said, "I will not tolerate disobedience in my class." The boy was crushed and capitulated. My mastery of the class was confirmed. But then I recalled that the parents of this 11-year-old boy had just divorced. This was not a happy child. It was a time when he needed understanding and support. I should have been a source of help. I failed. My needs took precedent over the needs of an 11-year-old boy.